and it is Monday, it is noon, and it is another edition of the Lunch Special on KZSU.
There's something happening here, but what it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there, telling me I got to beware. I think it's time we stop, children. What's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. There's battle lines being drawn. Nobody's right if everybody's wrong. Young people speak in their minds are getting so much resistance from behind. Time we stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. What a field day for the heat. And people in the street singing songs and carrying signs, mostly say hooray for our side. It's time we stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. Your life, it will creep. It starts when you're always afraid. Step out of line, the man come and take you away. We better stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going on. We better stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going on. We better stop now. What's that sound? Everybody look what's going on. We better stop.
Mother, mother, there's too many of you crying. Brother, 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 there's far too many of you dying. No, we've got to find a way to bring some loving here today. Yeah. Father, Father, we don't need to escalate. You see, war is not the answer, for only love can conquer hate. Picket signs, don't punish me with brutality. Talk to me so you can see. Yeah.
talk to me. You can't see what's going on. Yeah, what's going on? Tell me what's going on. I'll tell you what's going on.
Right, right on. Right on.
And welcome to another edition of the Lunch Special here on KZSU. And today, honored to have in the studio Professor of Political Science here at Stanford, Scott D. Sagan. Much, much more than that. But welcome to KZSU. Had you been on before, Scott?
I have not been here before, so
really?
It's a real pleasure.
We're honored to have you. Now, we were talking off mic, and you went to Oberlin College in Ohio, and you mentioned that I'd asked you if you'd been on the radio before like this, and you said, yeah, you had a...
I had my own show. I was a rookie freshman, so it was early on Friday mornings, and we'd get up and wake everybody up with some rock and roll.
Right on, man. How long did you do it?
Just my freshman year.
Okay. Well, it's great to have you, and you brought some amazing music. We just heard from Marvin Gaye right there, and before that, Buffalo Springfield. Those are two classic 60s songs. Did you... We don't want to ask how old you are, but did you come from that era?
I did come from that era, and since I teach on questions about the origins of war and the consequences of war, at least the first couple sets will be protest songs, both people who are protesting the United States being attacked and people who are protesting what the United States has done in response. Those two were about Vietnam. The first is actually about the... race riots going on in Watts in L.A. in 67, but widely became known as one of the classic Vietnam War songs. And what's going on was Marvin Gaye's response to what was going on in the late 60s, both in the black community and in the Vietnam vets coming back. And he imagined himself, I think his brother was in Vietnam and wrote to Marvin.
Oh.
And came back to Detroit and recorded that and a number of other songs in that period.
And that had some kind of effect on you because you brought it today.
That's right.
What do we have up next for the folks?
This is a song from 1980 by The Clash called Washington Bullets.
We got a Stanford professor playing The Clash. That's something.
Oh, mama, mama, look there. Your children are playing in the street again. Don't you know what happened down there? A youth of 14 got shot down there. The cocaine guns are jammed downtown. The killing clowns are blood money men. The shooting blows. Washington bullets again. As every cell in Chile will tell the cries of the tortured men. Remember Allende and the days before, before the army came. Please remember Victor Jara in the Santiago Stadium. Verdad, those Washington bullets again. And in the Bay of Pigs in 1961, Havana for the playboy in the Cuban sun. For Castro is the color is a redder than red. Those Washington bullets won Castro dead. For Castro is the color. Double a new spray of lead. Washington bullet, what else could you do?
And the new star.
If we can find enough
Afghan rebel that the Moscow bullet missed. Ask him what he thinks of voting communist. Ask the Dalai Lama in the hills of Tibet. How many monks did the Chinese get in a war-torn swamp? Stop any mercenary and check the British bullets in his armory.
Clash for your Monday afternoon here with Scott D. Sagan, professor of political science here at Stanford, and much, much more. We're just going to find out more in the bottom of the hour. Scott, why the Clash?
That was a song written opposing U.S. policies in Latin America at the time. And not only do I think it's a great protest song, but I remember at the time that this was very different for the Clash. You're not quite sure that that's the Clash when you hear them. So they were experimenting a lot.
Yeah, that would sound like island music or something, like they just got back from St. Martin. Or
maybe that's true. I'm not sure. But this became a popular song for a brief period of time, both supporting the Sandinistas, whom the United States was fighting in Nicaragua, and then also relaying the history of U.S. intervention in Chile. But to the Clash's credit, they actually also criticized the Soviet Union and the People's Republic of China for some of their repressive policies at the end before they go into their yelping and their dancing at the end.
Good for them. Now, when this came out and you first heard it, where were you working?
I was actually finishing my PhD at Harvard at the time, mm-hmm. and then went in soon thereafter and worked for 2 years for the Organization of the Joint Chiefs of Staff in the Pentagon.
Interesting. We're going to find out more about that at the bottom of the hour. What do we have up next for the folks?
Now we have two songs after the 9/11 attacks on the United States by Bruce Springsteen, Lonesome Day, and then The Rising.
This questions before you shoot. Deceit and betrayals, bitter fruits, hard to swallow, come the time to pay. That taste on your tongue will easily slip away. Let him come, I'm gonna find my way. Yeah, through this lonesome day.
Coming up behind, make my way through this darkness. I can't feel nothing but this chain that binds me. Lost track of how far I've gone, how far I've gone, how high I've climbed. On my back's a 60-pound stone, on my shoulder half mile of line. Catfish dancing on the end of my line.
sky of blackness and sorrow,
dream of love,
sky of love, sky of tears,
dream of love,
sky of glory and sadness,
dream of love,
sky of mercy, sky of fear,
dream of love,
sky of memory and shadow,
dream of love,
your burning wind fills my heart tonight, sky of longing and emptiness, sky of full, sky of blessed light. Come on up for the rising. Come on up, lay your head to mine. Come on up for the rising. Come on up for the rising tonight. La 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 la.
Little Bruce Springsteen for your listening pleasure this Monday afternoon, here with Professor of Political Science and much, much more, Scott D. Sagan. And no, not related to Carl, just so I know everybody's asking that question. We didn't get any phone calls yet, but I asked it, and Scott, you did let me know. You've been asked that a million times. As a matter of fact, somebody
asked that question billions and billions of times.
Somebody famous asked you that question, didn't they?
In 2002, I was in Cuba for a meeting of the survivors of the Cuban Missile Crisis, and Fidel Castro, in the reception line as the guests came through, asked me in Spanish through his translator, am I related to Carl Sagan? I said, no, but I've been asked that question billions and billions of times. And unfortunately, he had never seen the Nova show, in which Carl Sagan always talked about billions and billions of stars. So through his translator, Fidel said, I'm sorry if I asked you a stupid question.
Oh,
no. And I realized, I've just insulted a communist dictator in his homeland in front of cameras. This is the stupidest thing I've ever done.
So both of you guys felt kind of dumb at the same time,
right? That's right. But he had more power than I did. So I simply said, no, Mr. President, I was making a silly joke because Dr. Sagan used to say billions and billions of stars. But I think we should change the subject and talk about why Cuba should ratify the Non-Proliferation Treaty. And he put his arm around me and said, yes, let's change the subject and talk about the Non-Proliferation Treaty.
Now, does Cuba have, they don't have nuclear weapons,
no,
right?
But they were the holdouts, one of the few holdouts up until 2002 against ratifying the agreement. They said it was a nuclear apartheid regime, that some countries have them, some countries don't. Why should the countries that don't have them agree never to get them? So they were holding off. But eventually, Cuba did sign and ratify it. So now we have 189 members are in the treaty, and the only people who are not are Israel, India, Pakistan, and the North Koreans.
You know, it is the bottom of the hour, and we might as well do this now. You are one of the most foremost authorities on nuclear weapons, nuclear war. You've studied this, right?
I've studied it from the period when I worked in the Pentagon. My PhD also dealt with deterrence theory, and for number of years that I've been working here at Stanford, I've been writing on the relationship between nuclear power, the spread of nuclear weapons, and nuclear proliferation.
And that's what you teach here at Stanford?
I do. I teach a large course called International Security in a Changing World, and I'm co-director of the Center for International Security and Cooperation, CSAC, which is both a teaching unit. It helps, has an honors program for undergraduates, but it's primarily a research unit where it brings postdocs and pre-docs and faculty from around the world to come to Stanford and to write books and articles on both nuclear questions, but also questions about military intervention elsewhere, about the problems of civil war, big international security problems.
What's the state of the future? You have your finger on the pulse of students that are studying this. What do you see as, you know, students coming out of college and out of university and dealing with this?
I think many students are very interested. The question of nuclear power is very much on everyone's mind, both because it's one of the few, at least short-term solutions we have to address the question of greenhouse gases, because it is a relatively green technology. And yet Fukushima should remind us that the risk of an accident, and the North Korean case should remind us of the fact that some countries could cheat on their agreement and use a facility that was supposed to be for civilian purposes to actually make bombs material.
Did North Korea do that?
That's exactly how North Korea got the bomb.
Oh.
So they're a member of the treaty, and when we accused them of cheating, they finally said, you know, you're right. Nothing you can do about it. And we were bogged down in Iraq, which is the subject of the next song.
All right. Let's go on to that, and we'll get back to some more of your vital statistics in a little while. What is this next song? Set this up.
This is a song by Joe Henry from the album 2007, Civilians, called Our Song, the only song that I know that both is a protest against the war in Iraq and a wonderful tribute to Willie Mays.
Wow.
I saw Willie Mays at a Scottsdale Home Depot, looking at garage door springs at the far end of the 14th row. His wife stood there beside him. She was quiet and they both were proud. I gave them room but was close enough that I heard him when he said out loud, "This was my country, this was my song. Somewhere in the middle there, though it started badly and it's ending wrong, this was my country, this frightful and this angry land. But it's my right if the worst of it might still somehow make me a better man." The sun is unforgiving and there's nobody would choose this town, but we've squandered so much of our goodwill that there's nowhere else will have us now. We push in line at the picture show for cool air and a chance to see a vision of ourselves portrayed as younger and braver and humble and free. This was our country, this was our song. Somewhere in the middle there, though it started bad and it's ending wrong, this was our country, this frightful and it's my right if the worst of it might still somehow make me a better man. I've started something I can't finish, and I barely leave the house, it's true. I keep a wrap on my sores and joints, but yes, I've had my blessings too. I've got my mother's pretty feet, and a factory keeps my house in
and shame. My children, they've both been paroled, and we get by on the peace we've made. I feel safe, so far from heaven, from towers and their ocean views. From here I see the future coming across what soon will be beaches too. But that was him, I'm almost sure. The greatest center fielder of all time, stooped by the burden of endless dreams. His and yours and mine, he hooked each spring beneath his foot. He leaned over, then he stood upright, testing each against his weight. For one that had some play and some fight, he's just like us, I want to tell him. And our needs are small enough, something to slow a heavy door, something to help us raise one up. This was my country, this was my song. Somewhere in the middle there, though it started badly and it's ending wrong. Well, this was God's country, this frightful and this angry land. But if it's his will, the worst of it might still somehow make me. His will, the worst of it might still somehow make me a better man.
Sitting in a crummy movie with my hands on my chin. Oh, the violence that occurs seems like we never win. Oh, love and mercy, that's what you need tonight. So came on TV. A lot of people out there hurting, and it really scares me. Well, it's just not fair.
So love and mercy to you and your friends.
getting a little weepy on this Monday afternoon with Professor of Political Science and much, much more, Scott D. Sagan, not related to Carl, in case you just tuned in. Hey, that was some beautiful stuff right there.
Well, I thought it would be very nice after having the protest songs to also have songs about why we need more love and mercy in the world.
Yeah, and talk about that a little bit. That's a very interesting record you played off of.
Well, that was a cover version by a young artist from L.A. named Randy Stonehill of a Brian Wilson from the Beach Boys song. Wilson, after he had his breakdown and the Beach Boys fell apart and he left it, went into seclusion for quite a long time, became a recluse. He emerged to write a number of songs, is now healthy and back on the road, which is great. But I think that's one of his best songs, not as well known, about how to deal with depression by having love and mercy for others.
And it came off this record that apparently they made a compilation of a bunch of different artists doing
all
his songs.
Yeah, in 1988 they made a compilation called Making God Smile. I may not have the date entirely right on that. I think 88 was when Wilson first issued this, and this was maybe just 4 or 5 years ago that Making God Smile came out for his birthday, and local artists from L.A., no one very famous, took their favorite song by Brian Wilson and made a cover, and I thought that was particularly touching.
Yeah, very cool. And before that, we heard from... Who was that just before Brian Wilson?
It was Joe Henry.
Oh, right.
Who could combine
Willie Mays
and
protest of the Iraq War.
Yeah, this is my country, and angry land, but somehow it'll make me a better man.
And it all happened because he saw him at Home Depot.
Yeah, it was so probably here in Palo Alto. I don't know.
Very interesting. Very interesting. Before we get a little too far, I just do want to let people know you were born in Dearborn, Michigan. You went to Oberlin College in Ohio to get your undergrad between 73 and 77. You got your PhD in Harvard. You went to Oxford for a summer in 75. And then you went to work for the Pentagon between 83 and 85. Interesting time, the Reagan administration. And you went back to teach at Harvard in political science between 86 and 87. And then you've been here at Stanford since 87.
That's right.
That's quite a while.
I'm a vet.
Did you plan on staying this long here at Stanford?
No, my wife and I moved out here, never having lived on the West Coast. Had no idea that we would spend so much of our lives out here, but have enjoyed it tremendously. It's a great part of the country, great part of the world, and indeed this is a fantastic university. It's a real privilege to be teaching here, to have such great students, and to have such great resources to conduct research that is not just academic in flavor, but also hopefully has a wider impact on the governments or the wider public.
Yeah, because you came to Stanford with kind of a history. You had worked at the Pentagon. You had worked in the government, so to speak. You've written books, too, quite a few.
I've written a lot of books and a lot of articles, and I think that good scholarship should engage a wider audience, and that we don't write just to promote knowledge, although that's a key component. We want to develop knowledge and hopefully use that knowledge to help make the world a better place. And that's what I try to do with my work.
You think it's worked? Have you had an effect on public policy?
There are occasions where there have been changes in public policy because of my work or the work of other Stanford scholars.
Really?
Sure.
Mention a couple spots where you found that in your work.
Well, I think, for example, in recent years, a number of us who were consulting the Pentagon and the Commission on the Nuclear Posture Review were able to encourage the Obama administration to change U.S. nuclear weapons policy so that we no longer threaten to use nuclear weapons against other countries who don't have nuclear weapons and are in compliance with their nonproliferation treaty commitments. That was announced in April 2010 as a change in U.S. policy, and in May 2010, the Nonproliferation Treaty Review Conference got together at the United Nations headquarters, and a number of countries that had opposed having more regulations on the spread of nuclear power and having more inspections switched their position. And that was in part because they saw that the Obama administration was doing a lot to reduce the numbers of nuclear weapons and to reduce the threats that we were posing to other countries. So I think that actually both was a better thing in and of itself, better policy for the United States, but also had this secondary positive effect of encouraging other countries to be more cooperative in our efforts to reduce the spread of nuclear weapons to other nations.
Kind of lead by example, huh?
I think it's very important to lead by example.
How long had we had that policy of holding the right to attack somebody with nuclear weapons that didn't have any?
We held it for a long time, in part because we've never had a no first use policy in the United States. We've always said that we might use nuclear weapons first because we faced during the Cold War a conventionally superior adversary in the Soviet Union. Mm-hmm. And we were also concerned even during the Korean War when the Communist Chinese attacked us in North Korea that we might have to use nuclear weapons. And Eisenhower believed, without much evidence, that it was his hints about using nuclear weapons that got the Chinese to come to the negotiation table at the end of the Korean War.
What do you think? You think it worked?
No. I actually think the nuclear threat was not what was the main cause, but nonetheless, what was important was that's what Eisenhower believed. So he maintained a policy of using nuclear weapons first under lots of circumstances. It's very hard for people to say that we shouldn't use the biggest weapons that we have under lots of circumstances. In 1991, during the first Gulf War, the Bush administration, George H.W. Bush, Bush Sr., made a private decision that he was not going to use nuclear weapons, even if Saddam Hussein used chemical or biological weapons against U.S. troops. But he didn't want to say that out loud because that would encourage the Iraqis to do such a thing. And so some people afterwards say that the main reason why Iraq didn't use chemical or biological weapons against us in 1991 was because we hinted that we might use nuclear weapons. I don't think that's true. I think it's far more likely that what stopped Saddam Hussein from doing this was that he wanted to keep the chemical weapons back in Baghdad to use against us if we marched all the way to Baghdad.
Oh,
so we were actually very lucky, but I don't think our nuclear threat had much to do with it.
Interesting. Scott D. Sagan, professor of political science and authority on nuclear weapons, power, and proliferation in the country, and just honored to have you on the air today.
It's a real pleasure to be here.
Former DJ at Oberlin College in Ohio, and that had to be 1973 then, huh?
That's right.
We're getting back to it. What do we got up next for the folks?
Well, you mentioned that I was from Dearborn, Michigan, so we can't get out of Michigan without loving Aretha Franklin.
Oh, yeah.
So here we have her singing a Robbie Robertson song with Duane Allman on the slide guitar, The Wait.
I pulled into Nazareth. I was feeling about a half past dead. I just need some place where I can lay my head. Shook my hand, and that was all it said. Take a load off, Fanny. Take a load off for free. Take a load off, Fanny. And hey, yeah, yeah, put the way on me. I picked up my bag. When I was coming in the devil, walking side by
It was a classic in its day. It's called Layla, Derek and the Dominoes. That was Dwayne Allman and Eric Clapton. And my guest today, Scott D. Sagan, professor of political science here at Sanford, and much, much more. Scott, we have just a brief amount of time, but why'd you bring that song?
It is one of my favorites, both the lead guitar work by Eric Clapton, the secondary guitar work by Dwayne Allman, the song, and then the coda at the end going into almost a classic, classical riff at the end is terribly moving. And we've talked about nuclear weapons and war and protests and terrorism, but I thought we should end the hour on a bit more positive note. The final song is the Louis Armstrong classic, What a Wonderful World, but done more recently in a cover with the frog-like Lou Reed singing the lead in both English and then a Spanish version of the song coming out right afterwards.
Very cool. Thanks for coming. Can you come back sometime soon?
I would love to.
That'd be great.
What a Wonderful World.
See trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you, and I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I see skies of blue, clouds of white, the bright blessed day, the dark sacred night, and I think to myself, what a wonderful world. The colors of the rainbow, so pretty in the sky, are also on the faces of the people going by. I see friends shaking hands, saying, how do you do? They're really saying, I love you. I hear babies crying, I watch them grow. They'll learn much more than I'll ever know. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
Sleep me, bebé. We are all here, buscando la luz in the city, so that you may hear the laughter, el cantar y el gozar through the night. Arurú, mi nene, arurú, mi nena, y que duermas con los ángeles. Arurú, mi nene, arurú, mi nena, y que duermas con los ángeles. Lay your lids heavy so that little sol and little moon can gather the stars and sprinkle them. En el cielo de tus sueños, you'll see the two of them in tus ojos. Never feeling alone in este mundo. So sleep, mi bebé, arurú, mi nena. We are all here, buscando la luz en este mundo, buscando la luz in this world.